Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. Well, one of the things that we have to protect our country against, enemies foreign becoming domestic, is the insecure border. It is becoming, it seems, if it were possible, even more insecure by the day. And the kinds of people that are taking advantage of that insecurity seem to be becoming more dangerous by the day. At least we have reason to believe that's the case. No one follows this more closely and more courageously, I would argue, than our guest. His name is Todd Bensman, no stranger to this program or others in this network and elsewhere. He is the author most recently of Overrun, about how Joe Biden has created the greatest border crisis in U.S. history. He's also, and very relevant to today's topics, the author of America's Secret Border War, which talks about the jihadis that we're contending with coming across the border. Then, Todd, thank you. As always, your work at the Center for Immigration Studies, where you're its National Security Fellow, is simply indispensable. We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with you. Welcome back. I gather you've just returned from the border.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time at the border the last couple of weeks. So I'm just back from the Rio Grande Valley, Reynosa, Mexico, and Brownsville, Texas.
Great. Well, welcome home, and God bless you for doing what you know is so desperately needed at this point, which is literally putting eyes on the situation and reporting authentically and authoritatively about what's going on there. Of course, here in Washington, we're told there's really nothing to see there, folks. It's all good, all secure, nothing to worry about. Level set for us. Overrun is, of course, your theme. How bad is it, and how bad is it seemingly likely to get next month?
Well, Title 42 ends on May 11. It's scheduled to end on May 11. And
remind us what that does.
And the reason that that's important is because that was the instant expulsion policy, denial of asylum for all immigrants that cross illegally. Of course, the Biden administration had reduced the use of it down to somewhere in the neighborhood of about 30%, 70% of everybody else got in through it exempted. But still, that 30% was a something, and they've been using it as a kind of a cattle prod lately to keep people in Mexico and put them in line for these humanitarian permits that they could apply for on an app. But what I saw over the last couple of weeks is that that app program and all of the lines and queues that had formed behind it is collapsing. And people are just blowing it off. They're not waiting. They're peeling off the back of the line from Mexico and crowding in over the border again, claiming asylum at the border. And we were going to use 42 to beat them back in, but now we're not even using it. A great many of those people are being allowed into the country, admitted. Just yesterday, I interviewed scores of them at the bus station in McAllen with their papers, going to Chicago, Denver, Indianapolis, New York, everywhere. They're just heading across the border again. And they're coming over by the thousands now. Brownsville, Texas, they just blew it off. No online app and waiting for humanitarian permission. Just pouring through. I saw like 2,500 in one big group. Videotaped it and everything. In Juarez, it's that way every single day. Juarez, El Paso. And so we're seeing the steady collapse of that cornerstone Biden administration program. It's failing.
Yeah, such as it is. I mean, the two elements, I guess, the Title 42 and this, well, as you've described it, I think, this so-called humanitarian processing.
I put that in big air quotes.
I know.
It's illegal. Litigation about it. It's completely illegal.
Well, I think you've made the case very compellingly, Todd, based on your firsthand observation, again, that it's really nothing more than a subterfuge for allowing this migration to go forward without that untidy business of long lines at the border and people coming across.
It's untidy again. It's untidy, yeah. And it's going to get way worse.
Yeah. And so the practical effect, you say the And one of the things I've appreciated about our many conversations about this over the years is you've always made the point that the problem is not just an insecure border or the policies that have essentially eliminated it. It's the tractor beam of the administration's other policies that incentivize people to come here. And obviously, those are all continuing to operate. And if they are, Todd, then the pent-up demand, if you will, the pipeline that is overflowing now coming up from the southern parts of this hemisphere and everywhere else around the world, for that matter, will obviously translate into a torrent once what little restraint that 42 provided is completely eliminated.
Yeah,
so, right. Todd, among the things that you and I visited about over the years that is so worrying about this, and I think especially these days, is the demographic makeup of this overflowing pipeline. And let's just say, for stipulation purposes, yes, there are families, there are women and children. But give us, just again, on the basis of your firsthand observations, a sense of how many of these folks turn out to be military age young men, fit and seemingly coming from some pretty dangerous places.
That's right. 40% of everyone reaching the southern border, crossing it, are from countries that are other than Mexico or Central America. They're coming from 160 different countries around the world. Just yesterday, I met my first Kyrgyzstanis, a family, mother, father, and looks like a daughter. They spoke English. They looked like Chinese nationals to me, but they said they were from Kyrgyzstan. But that just gives you an idea of the diversity coming. I was in Tijuana in November and met a whole bunch of Chechens. Military age guys, they said they were fleeing the Russian draft. Maybe they were, but who knows? Have the beard thing going and, wouldn't be, photographed or videotaped, unlike just about any other immigrant that I've met for the last 3 years down there. Lots of people from the Middle East, from Syria, lots of Somalis coming. Somalia is not a good place to be having a lot of immigrants, and Afghanis are coming. You name it, they're coming from places like China, from all over South Asia, Pakistan.
Speaking of China, I hear that there's a particular uptick seemingly taking place there. And I've seen photographs of, long queues of, again, not just Chinese nationals, but Chinese nationals who fit this young, unaccompanied male military age demographic profile. Is that right?
Right. And we should just say it straight out that this is an espionage risk and a threat. The Chinese are well known for infiltrating spies throughout our university system, all of our best research systems. And that's overtly. They apply for the visas, they get let in, and then years after the damage is done, we find out that they're members of the PLA who were sent here to steal from us. So if the Chinese are willing to do that on a massive scale, which they have been, then why not send a bunch of them through the southern border? I have no doubt we will find that there were spies among them.
Yeah, look, spies is one thing, Todd. We have to take a very short break. When we talk on the other side of it, I want to visit with you about what else they might have in mind besides espionage, they and the jihadis and so on, and what we better be doing about it right quick. We'll be right back with more with Todd Bensman of the Center for Immigration Studies, the author most recently of Overrun, must reading. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The long-suffering people of Sudan have lately been subjected to yet another round of barbaric oppression at the hands of Sharia supremacist generals. This has gone on for decades, with the exception of a recent brief interlude when such officers promised a transition to civilian rule. The latest violence has been precipitated by a conflict between what amount to rival uniformed mafia dons over who will next misrule the country. Mostly unnoted, however, is the enabler of the Sudanese jihadists, namely the Chinese Communist Party. It has long worked with them to exploit Sudan's vast oil deposits and otherwise supported those in Khartoum who, despite their profession of solidarity with fellow Muslims, are willing to work with Chinese deeply contemptuous of the people of Sudan and genocidally persecuting Uyghur co-religionists in China. We must hold accountable the CCP and its friends. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're visiting with Todd Bensman, the extremely accomplished, well, former journalist, former intelligence officer with the Department of Public Safety in his native state of Texas. Now a national security fellow for the very, very important Center for Immigration Studies. You can find his writings in all the right places. He appears prominently in lots of outlets in the media. We're always pleased to have him with us, and especially to be able to talk with him about two important recent books. One is the new one, Overrun, and the other is America's Covert Border War. And Todd, in that latter book, you spoke of the very serious problem of having what I call Sharia supremacists, jihadis, Islamists, there are lots of different names for them, but they're people who believe it is Allah's will that they engage in holy war to advance the triumph of Islam worldwide. You've described a number of places that you've personally seen people coming from that have that tradition. And it may or may not be the motivation of the people that are coming here, or it may be that they would be susceptible to recruitment or inducements of other kinds once they got here. But talk a little bit about, again, the danger that these folks are not simply here to collect intelligence, whether they're Chinese or Iranians or Somalis or somebody else, but that they're here for a purpose that could be expressed in potentially quite, well, maybe even catastrophic violence at some point down the road. I'm worried, of course, about the people that are coming here illegally, as you've been documenting, and as we talk about frequently. I'm also worried about those that we brought in here legally as refugees from Taliban Afghanistan. And it seems to me a matter of ticking time bombs. Am I wrong?
Right. Well, I recently wrote a piece for the New York Post that details a case that has received zero national publicity about an Iraqi who was indicted in Ohio for plotting to bring four terrorist operatives, ISIS operatives, over the southern border to assassinate President George Bush. Thank God the FBI got a couple of informants in there and were able to bust him, but not before he claimed to one of those informants that he'd already brought in two Hezbollah operatives over the southern border.
And what was his background in addition to being an Iraqi?
He had been a member of Al-Qaeda in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
That's right, the precursor to ISIS. And his job was to kill Americans with IEDs. His team killed a lot of Americans with IEDs. And he got into the country on an asylum claim. He overstayed a tourist visa, and we missed the intel about him and let him in. And then he immediately plotted to bring these four in over the southern border. And what this shows us, this is a case that's happening right now. He just pled guilty. It shows us that they're very aware that the southern border is now an easier way to gain access into the country than he got in by flying in on a tourist visa. And so we have to keep that in mind as context for the fact that so far this year, we've had 80 people on the FBI watch list cross over that border, in addition to the 98 that we caught last year. So 180, 190, probably maybe 200 by now, accounting for this month, people who are on the FBI's terror watch list that we caught amid 1.5 million gotaways that we didn't catch. And so,
and Todd, among how many others that we don't happen to know about that should be on a watch list but aren't? I mean, this, again, ticking time bomb, maybe it's a thermonuclear bomb, I don't know, but whatever it is a potential danger to our people of potentially, as I say, incalculable magnitude. And I wanted to ask you, Todd, in connection with all of this, a woman who I think is rightly assumed to have been a driving force behind this open border policy was, until very recently, President Biden's domestic policy advisor. She had, interestingly enough, been previously President Obama's national security advisor, and before that, President Obama's UN ambassador. Her name is Susan Rice. She is one of those who prompts many of us to think that, well, as Barack Obama himself proclaimed at one point, I think it was in Axios magazine several months back, maybe a year ago now, that 90% of the Biden White House is made up of people from his administration. She certainly was. And it raises the question as to whether we're really watching the third Obama term. But what do you make of her departure? Does it bear on any policy change, do you think, in this regard, among others?
I have a very different take on the departure of Susan Rice than most conservatives. And I'll tell you what it is, because I dedicate a whole chapter of my new book, Overrun, to what I call the White House Rebellion. There was an attempt, an aggressive, robust attempt by White House pragmatists, people who were kind of more traditional Democrats like Susan Rice and Ron Klain, to unseat and overturn the progressive liberal factions that had gotten into the White House and are responsible for opening the borders. Now, they weren't doing it out of like some feeling that this is good for America, but they were doing it because the midterms were coming up and they were worried about the political fallout of a mass migration crisis. So Susan Rice was among a small cohort of kind of traditional old school liberals who tried to stop this mass migration. They actually put in place numerous policies that were designed, that were downright Trumpian, to shut this thing down before it became a political liability for the midterm elections. And my concern is that for whatever reasons they did it, it happened to be a good thing that they did what they did, but the departure of Ron Klain and Susan Rice actually leaves very few, if any, voices of opposition left in the White House as Title 42 comes and falls apart, and we start to see this truly, truly new tidal wave of humanity cross. So my take on it is a little bit different. Susan Rice, Klain, and some of those old school Democrats were actually oppositionists to the mass migration crisis that's going on right now. And I think that their departure is not good for border security. They are liberals. They were doing it for their own self-interest. They wanted to retain power. I get that. But sometimes that's how democracy works, out of self-interest. And the common good is the cherry on top.
Well, listen, that's an alternative perspective. I have thought the worst of her for many years. And you know, when you say old style Democrats, I used to work for one by the name of Scoop Jackson, and Susan Rice is no Scoop Jackson. Ron Klein is no Scoop Jackson.
No, it's all
relative, to the lunatic
spectrum.
Left.
I mean, relative to the liberal, maybe progressives,
more responsible.
Yeah, the progressives that are in there are yeah. crazy. They're yeah. Looney Tunes. These guys.
Well, and unfortunately, they apparently, as you say, will now have the run of the place, and.
They run
whether that will in fact translate into problems for Biden if he does in fact go the distance on his reelection campaign remains to be seen. But what I appreciate so much about you, Todd Bensman, is you are truth-telling about it all. You call him as you see him, and you go down and look at what's going on. You're not simply basing your assessments on somebody else's reporting. Thank you for that work. Thank you for this terrific new book, Overrun. I hope everybody will check it out, as well as America's Secret Border War. We'll talk with you soon, my son, my friend. God bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined a remarkable man hailing originally from Romania, who somehow managed to find his way to South Korea to study what's going on in North Korea, and it's become his life's work to try to promote human rights in North Korea. He runs as the executive director a very important organization for that purpose, the Committee on Human Rights in North Korea. And he's a man that we often turn to, among other things, for assessments of what's going on inside this hermit kingdom, as they call it, with horrifying implications for its own people and possibly for the people across the demilitarized zone and maybe the rest of us as well. He's a friend as well as a very valued colleague, and we're delighted to have a chance to catch up with him in the wake of some seemingly important developments in the relationship between the United States and South Korea. A featured White House state visit with the president of South Korea yesterday, and in the course of the day today, an address to the joint session of Congress by that South Korean president. Greg, it's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about what has developed in the space of the past few hours.
The pleasure is all mine, Frank. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. So sort of do a quick lay of the land for us as to why announcements made yesterday reflect a heightened degree of concern, I think it's fair to say, both in Washington and Seoul, about what's going on in, well, Pyongyang.
Frank, let's go back to the fundamentals. Why are there 28,500 U.S. forces, Korea, American troops stationed in South Korea? Because on the 25th of June, 1950, Kim Il-sung's North Korea invaded the South. We don't have a peace treaty in place. We only have an armistice in place. According to a 2021 study by the RAND Corporation, North Korea will be in possession of 200 nuclear warheads by the year 2027, which is an arsenal comparable to the United Kingdom or France, and by that time, half of China's. This is a very serious matter. So South Koreans have begun flirting with the idea of developing a domestic nuclear deterrent because, of course, they've begun to doubt U.S. commitment to the U.S. ROK alliance, the U.S.-South Korea alliance. According to a recent study by the Asan Institute, 53% of South Koreans would be in favor of developing such a deterrent. Of course, this would come at a great price. South Korea would have to pull out of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. South Korea is all about economic development. It's all about these great global conglomerates. You name them, you know, Samsung, Hyundai, LG. South Korea would witness tremendous damage if it were to take that route. So this is the first state visit.
You're saying that those conglomerates would be punished
they would
with
be punished
trade restrictions and other things?
No doubt about it.
Even if what's so clearly taking place in this context would be a response, not an unreasonable one, it seems to me, to that great and seemingly growing threat across the border.
On the upside, the South Koreans are willing and ready to take their fate into their own hands and basically take charge of their national defense. This is the first state visit by a South Korean president to the United States in 12 years. The very important message and powerful message that has been issued is the following. And we have all seen the Washington Declaration. The Republic of Korea has full confidence in U.S. extended deterrence commitments and recognizes the importance, necessity, and benefit of its enduring reliance on the U.S. nuclear deterrent. For the first time in 40 years, we're going to dock U.S. nuclear submarines in South Korean ports. Is that just a symbolic gesture? No, it's not. It's a signal that we are fully committed to this alliance, friendship, and partnership that we have had with South Korea for 70 years now. The message sent to North Korea is, if you take any missteps here, you will be obliterated. South Korea does not need a domestic nuclear deterrent. The United States has never given a sign that we're not committed to the defense of all friends in the Republic of Korea.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate here, Craig. I know that this is something you've given a lot of thought to over the years. I'm a little concerned, I have to tell you, that the credibility of our deterrent, let alone our extended deterrent, specifically, you know, sort of the short range tactical nuclear weapons that might be the most, you know, important direct response to the kinds of threats that South Korea is facing from. And who knows, you say 200 nuclear weapons, that may be right. I'm pretty sure that it's not half of the Chinese force. I think it's considerably larger in China and quite possibly larger than 200 in South Korea, in North Korea at the moment as well. But the point is this, docking nuclear submarines that have no short-range nuclear weapons on them, because we've taken them off, is a symbolic gesture, to be sure. But whether it really enhances the kind of deterrent that we're seeking and that I think the South Koreans believe is needed or not, I don't know. And, you know, and from my point of view, I tend to be rather more understanding of a nation's desire to not have to rely on somebody else, especially given the unreliability of the Biden administration, to put a fine point on it. Your thoughts?
Well, our nuclear submarines have always been ready to deploy in case of a contingency on the Korean Peninsula. Perhaps, you know, this is a symbolic gesture, but it's very important in terms of reassuring the South Korean public that we are fully committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Of course, misjudgment, pertaining to commitment to extended deterrence on the other side could have absolutely catastrophic consequences. So we need to clearly signal to the North Koreans, to these revisionist great powers, Russia, China, this revisionist powers that are trying to fundamentally transform the international system we established after World War II, that we're fully committed to basically protecting this international order. And that's why it's so important. You're absolutely right. You know, the technical details might not add up, but in terms of reassuring the South Korean public that the alliance is here to protect them, I think this is extraordinarily important.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm very much of the view that those 20,000 U.S. personnel in a sort of tripwire defensive arrangement are vital. I'm just saying that I would think that it behooves us, and the Biden administration has specifically, as you know, rejected this, to have weapons aboard those vessels that would actually constitute a deterrent. I mean, it's one thing if you told me that we're going to have 20,000 men on the DMZ or in proximity to it, and none of them would be armed, I would say, I'm not sure that that would do the job of deterring the North Koreans. You could argue, well, if they come across the border, they're going to hurt those Americans. But the idea is to tell them that we're going to hurt the North Koreans if they think about coming across that border and disarmed, well, guys on the ground or, disarmed guys on the ground or disarmed submarines. And they're not completely disarmed, obviously, but they don't have that that nuclear capability. Let me pivot to one other piece of this. And I wanted just to, again, thank you for your contribution to this important book. It's entitled Living with Dictators. And it was mostly crafted around something that before this new president was elected, thank God, in South Korea, seemed to be an actual potential problem. You alluded to it. We don't have a peace treaty between the United States or the United States and South Korea, more to the point, and North Korea as a result of the Korean War. We've had an armistice. Is there still talk about trying to get a peace treaty? Is that any more advisable today than it was then? Is that essentially off the table? And are we really right back where we, I think, have had to be all along, which is having credible capabilities to defeat, if necessary, to hopefully deter the North Korean regime?
Frank, we've tried everything with the North Koreans. We've tried the Geneva Agreed Framework, the six-party talks, the Leap Day Agreement, strategic patience, summit diplomacy. In my personal view, the Biden administration will not flirt with the idea of talking or negotiating with the North Koreans. Of course, we tell them that we are open to negotiations, so if a window were open, it's okay. But the thing is that there is, you know, we all learn in school about this, about the zone of possible agreement, about the ZOPA. What the North Koreans want is recognition as a nuclear power, the establishment of full diplomatic relations with the United States. We cannot do that. We cannot provide a blueprint for other rogue regimes to commit crimes against humanity, treat their people like dirt, rape them, kill them, put them into political prison camps, and then pull out of the NPT, develop nuclear weapons, and be safe and sound.
Well, so, to say nothing, they want those 20,000 guys off the peninsula as well, all of which I think is exceedingly dangerous. Greg, we have to leave it at that. I thank you so much for the work you do. I want to commend to our audience hrnk.org as a place where you can follow Greg Scarlatou's work. His publications are terrific. And I hope that you'll come back with updates on all of this, Greg. It's a very, very important time, and we must rise to it. God bless you, my friend. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The long-suffering people of Sudan have lately been subjected to yet another round of barbaric oppression at the hands of Sharia supremacist generals. This has gone on for decades, with the exception of a recent brief interlude when such officers promised a transition to civilian rule. The latest violence has been precipitated by a conflict between what amount to rival uniformed mafia dons over who will next misrule the country. Mostly unnoted, however, is the enabler of the Sudanese jihadists, namely the Chinese Communist Party. It has long worked with them to exploit Sudan's vast oil deposits and otherwise supported those in Khartoum who, despite their profession of solidarity with fellow Muslims, are willing to work with Chinese deeply contemptuous of the people of Sudan and genocidally persecuting Uyghur co-religionists in China. We must hold accountable the CCP and its friends. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of our favorite guests. Her name is Christine Douglas Williams. She is an award-winning, multiple times award-winning journalist based in Canada, but who has a number of other very important careers, notably in the Race Relations Commission of Canada, as well as now as a contributing editor to our friend Robert Spencer's terrific online resource, jihadwatch.org. Christine is the author of a number of important books, including one chronicling her experiences with the Canadian government and its race relations. Also, you know, the prospects for a moderation of Islam. And Christine, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about a meeting that took place, I don't know, 6 weeks or so ago, maybe in Beirut, Lebanon, convened, I'm told, by the people who actually own Lebanon these days, namely Iran, and featuring a very unsavory company. Tell us who they were and what their purpose was, as you understand it.
I'm going to dive right in, Frank. It is Hamas and Hezbollah. Senior Hamas officials and senior Hezbollah officials. Now, I want to start by saying something to you.
And I think Palestinian Islamic Jihad was in
yes,
if I'm not mistaken, and sort of other bad actors. Go ahead.
Right. But the very important, critical part of this was a point that Israeli Defense Minister said very recently, that Hezbollah was actually the key source of the escalation. Most people would expect it to be Hamas, because we saw what happened, particularly with Operation Guardian of the Wall in 2021, and we know about the rocket launches into Israel coming from Hamas. But when you look at it, when you look at the funding coming in from Iran, he had pointed out that some $700 million was going toward Hezbollah, and some $100 million going toward Hamas. So that tells you a lot. Now, what has been happening is that...
And when you talk about, you know, the relative responsibility for escalation, it's against Israel, of course.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's all about Israel.
Fine point on it.
And what is so key about these issues and these meetings that they're having, this is something that's gaining news headlines, but it didn't start overnight. All of their documents talked about the constant theme about obliterating Israel from the very beginning. In fact, from 1948, you could say there was that ambition, and now it's being portrayed as a resistance. But now that we see the turbulence going on in Israel, the internal struggles going on, it is prime time that the enemies say, look, we have to strike the iron while it's hot. We know what's been going on the Temple Mount. It has been rising. I'm trying to make a long story short here. It's always being centered around, oh, the Israelis are causing trouble. They're storming the Al-Aqsa compound. And a lot of people don't even realize that the Temple Mount is actually called the Al-Aqsa compound by these groups, by the Palestinians. So even according to the status quo, which when you think about it was negotiated by one fellow, every Israeli did not abide by it, number one. And number two, even though they didn't abide by it, they have been trying to. The official position of the government of Israel, the Netanyahu government, is the status quo right now. And while you can't stop somebody from praying inside, we don't see this, but they accuse Israel of storming. And this is what's given rise to these kinds of meetings that we're seeing now in Beirut, with the worst elements of the jihad now coming together to say, we have to escalate. We have to find our way to destroy Israel. This is what's happening here.
And Christine, this is against the backdrop, of course, of one other important development, which is, we believe, the actual acquisition by the Iranian regime at long last of sufficient quantities of highly enriched uranium to have nuclear weapons. The administration is, you know, trying to profess that, you know, they haven't actually crossed the threshold to having those weapons yet, but that could happen at any time. And for all we know, it has happened. So the escalation, and what I think you're putting your finger on that is so troubling in this connection with Hezbollah, is the last count I had is something like 150,000 rockets and missiles are now in position in Hezbollah's control in southern Lebanon, capable of ranging the entirety of the Jewish state. And that, especially if they decide to pull the trigger on any of this, is going to translate into a regional war. I don't think there's any
Way around it, because Israel is not going to just go down without fighting. And the propaganda that has circulated through the world, also being propped up by the United Nations, which is, and this ties in to where the Organization of Islamic Cooperation sits, because it has been heavily influencing the UN through money, through other influences with propaganda through the years. In fact, the whole world is looking at Israel as some kind of an apartheid state and the resistance is legitimate, and it's not. So it puts a sort of blur as to what the issues really are when Israel is the one that's facing an existential threat. And these jihadist groups have tied themselves into what they try to portray as a cause that a lot of people, unfortunately, just don't understand.
Yeah, they don't understand. And the particular, you know, lack of understanding is what it will mean for those of us beyond Israel if, in fact, this regional war is unleashed.
Very much.
And we're going to come back to the UN on the other side of a very short break here in a moment, Christine, and the forces at work there. But just a further word on this Organization of Islamic Cooperation. I know that at Jihad Watch, you and Robert Spencer have done a lot of work on explicating what it is and what its purpose is. I've had it described, I think Robert's among those, as kind of the, you know, proto-caliphate of our time. Is that a correct way of thinking about it? And talk about its relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood in particular.
Absolutely, Frank, absolutely. And I know that there are those out there who are hesitant to say that it's a kind of a caliphate, but it really is. And if you had been following it, not the royal you, through several decades, you would see that it rises up when it feels that it has the opportunity to. And if you look at these members, first of all, people wonder about the discrepancy.
Some 57 countries, as I recall.
Well, it's 57, but it's really 56. If you want to call Palestine a state, it's really 56 countries.
An important correction. Hold the thought. We're going to come back with more on the OIC, as it's called, and the UN, and what they're doing together, and with another acronym, CCP. Stay tuned for all of that with Christine Douglas-Williams and more right after this. We're back. Christine Douglas Williams is in the house, one of the stars of jihadwatch.org, as well as our ally, working that particular front against, among others, the red-green axis. We're going to talk a little bit more about that with Christine right now. Christine, you were talking about the United Nations. No question that it is a leftist operation through and through, world government, or as they call it now, global governance, being one of its founding ideas, which is, of course, a communist enterprise, full stop. And under the Chinese Communist Party of these days, Xi Jinping's administration most especially, they're very active in the United Nations and seeking to advance through it a global governance agenda, perhaps as soon as this fall, to allow it to determine what constitutes a crisis and tell us what to do about anything that they designate as such. Very similar to what's going on in the World Health Organization, by the way. But another factor, as you mentioned, in addition to the red, socialist Marxists or so on, of the United Nations and other outfits, is the green, the red-green axis, as we call it, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, 56 nations plus Palestine, constituting Muslim majority membership of it. You were starting to tell us before the break about what its purpose is and why it's not incorrect to describe it as a kind of caliphate in the making.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation, first of all, Frank, and I think people underestimate this because they haven't been following it. One of its primary interests is what's going on in the Palestinian territories, which was very much related to its founding in the first place. So you would notice things like when the Operation Guardian of the Walls, it was necessitated because of the barrage of rocket fire coming from Hamas in 2021. It was the OIC that got together for an emergency summit on the urging of all people, Saudi Arabia. And they had this summit to discuss, well, how do we deal with this so-called problem that we have of Israel? And Israel was painted out to be the aggressor when there was no big discussion about what was going on with Hamas. So you see a problem right there. Another issue is, if you look at the United Nations Office of Counterterrorism donor list, they actually have that office in the United Nations. And the biggest funders from the OIC are actually on that list is Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Now, it doesn't even matter. And this was something that was pointed out by Giulio Miotti. He's known in counterterrorism circles as a journalist. And he pointed out that even though $1.5 billion is donated to Hamas by Qatar, in fact, Qatar is a heavy supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, it doesn't matter. They're buying out the counterterrorism donor list. And a lot of people get confused. What do they mean by counterterrorism when you're talking about the OIC? When you're looking at the heavy involvement with jihad terror, but people don't understand that terrorism for these groups do not refer to jihad terror the way we defined it. Terror refers to anybody that is opposed to their ideology. And I'll give you one example if you look at that people easily understand. If you look at Turkey, Erdogan is consistently rounding up dissidents and people that don't agree and saying that they're terrorists. The PKK, I know it, that's a loaded history, but these kinds of groups, anybody that do not agree with them, they're defined as terrorists and extremists. So we see the UN Office of Counterterrorism bought out. We're seeing more.
Now, when you say bought out, you mean that they're actually cooking the books on the kinds of terrorists that they're countering?
In terms of cooking the books, it's difficult to pinpoint that exactly to say that they are, but they are heavily influential, and they're the ones that are basically determining what the meaning of the word terrorism is. And I'll explain that, how it applies to the West, Frank. When you look at the word Islamophobia, and this is a basic example of Islamophobia, anybody who criticizes Islam is deemed to be Islamophobic. If you look at the United Nations and the OIC, more and more they're defining those who are guilty of Islamophobia as being the problems in the world that is causing issues when it comes to peace. So you stretch that a bit in the West, and all of a sudden, people who criticize the jihad and people that oppose their views are called the extremists, the terrorists. And we start seeing a pattern where white extremism becomes targeted because it is not in agreement with whatever they say. We're not saying that there isn't Nazism. That is very separate. But there is a, it's complex. There's a labeling. And it's something that insidiously weaved its way into the West so that if you're not in agreement with the red-green axis, actually, and I know we're talking about the green now, you are considered a terrorist. Saudi Arabia is always rounding up dissidents, throwing them in jail for no particular reason, and they're regarded as terrorists because they oppose the ideologies, the Wahhabi ideologies that are coming out of Saudi Arabia.
You mentioned earlier, Christine, that the Saudis had, been problematic. They have been for a long time, I think it's fair to say. But I think it's also been the case that particularly during the Trump administration, they were playing rather more closely and more constructively, not only with the United States, but even with Israel itself. In fact, there was much talk about an Abraham Accord between Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's obviously off the table now, not only because of the Chinese have brokered this modus vivendi, I guess for want of a better term, this separate peace between Saudi Arabia and Iran, now two clients of theirs, at least for the moment. But it's also, I think, the case that the Saudis have now begun openly meeting once again and apparently normalizing relations with Hamas, which it had been, you know, estranged from during that period of its rather better behavior. What's up with that? And isn't this a prime example of the problem that you've just put your finger on? You're calling terrorists something that they are not, and people who are not terrorists something that they are now calling terrorists.
Frank, they were, Saudi Arabia was playing a game. It was two-faced. If people were really reading the backstories, and we were publishing this on Jihad Watch, they would realize that, yes, there was a definite improvement to what we saw. We weren't seeing the same kind of petrodollars going into terrorism internationally. But Saudi Arabia...
The Brotherhood, too.
Right. But Saudi Arabia, we have forgotten, so to speak, is based on Wahhabism. It is the central Sunni nation of the world.
And Jihadism is still very much with us. Christine, unfortunately, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back with further updates on this soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will come back tomorrow. Until then, go forth and multiply.